Good evening. I'm Chuck, alcoholic.
Hi, everybody. I'm really honored to be here tonight. Thank you very much for this opportunity. To Ken and to Gene and to Janice for an interesting afternoon. I'm never going to do that again. Never, ever going to do that again. Until tomorrow, right. To the committee for allowing me this opportunity. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked in this fellowship to be a part of a meeting, any meeting, and you honor me tonight. Thank you very much. And it's a bit of a homecoming for me, which is nice. I came here after about 9 years of sobriety from Michigan. After about 9 months, excuse me, 9 months of sobriety, right. Anyway, we'll get into that later. My sobriety is March 26th of 1990. I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and have been for nearly 9 years now. My home group is the Northland Group of Austin, Texas, specifically the noon no smoking meetings. If anybody ever is in Austin, look us up on Northland Drive. Please join us. The Big Book directs me and suggests that I am to tell you a little bit about what my life was like, what happened to me, and what my life is like today. So in a general sense, I was born in Michigan in 1969. I will be 30 next month, almost middle-aged. No? Close. For all intents and purposes, had a really pretty normal upbringing, normal childhood. No, I can't remember, you know, falling off the pot or anything like that to cause this thing. But I do remember vividly my first drink and my first drunk. It was on a Saturday morning. I was probably 13. It was probably around 7:30 in the morning before a soccer game. My parents had had a party the night before, and they had left undrank bottles of beer and wine and whatever else. And I commenced on a Saturday morning while watching cartoons to walk around and start drinking these glasses. And if any of you all remember the movie Caddyshack, and the scene where he's walking around and drinking everything off the tables and then goes hurls in the Porsche, that's exactly what I did. Wasn't a Porsche, but the situation was the same. But at some point in time, after, I don't know which one it was, after it was the wine or the beer or the shot or whatever it was, I was there. And those of you who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about. It was it. I didn't know I was searching for it. I didn't know I was lost, but I found it. I wasn't drinking to escape. I wasn't drinking at somebody. I just drank. And instantaneously, I loved the effect that alcohol produced in me. Absolutely loved it. I'm certain I would still love it today, but I can't do it. Can't do it. And at 13 and 14 years old, one cannot get booze on a regular basis. So we would hoard everything together, and me and some friends would hoard for 2 or 3 weeks, and then we'd go out on a splurge and get hammered. And this happened maybe every couple of weeks or every month or something like that. But the key here is the pattern for me, is that if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, or thinking about drinking, or trying to think about drinking. It basically consumed my life from the start. Absolutely. And that's not a good place to be when you're, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old. They don't like you drinking before school. They don't like you drinking during lunch, and they don't like you drinking before soccer practice. I don't understand why. But it took me to places that I didn't know that I wanted to go. I didn't know that I wanted to go drink with the stoners. I didn't know if I wanted to go drink with these people. I was a chameleon. I could drink with anybody. And at that point in time, I thought it was pretty cool. Looking back, it was pretty sick. But I had that innate ability to drink under any circumstance. One specific application, which I always go back to if I ever want to remember what I was like at that period of my life, is my high school annual. There's a picture of me on Halloween in a tutu. And we had been out that morning. We got up at 6:30 in the morning, and we were drinking Bacardi 151 at Dunkin' Donuts. Why? I don't know why. Because it was the right thing to do. I couldn't think of a reason not to drink. I couldn't think of a situation. I cannot, to this day, think of a situation where I said, no, thank you, not tonight. No. Every opportunity that I had, I took it and ran with it. And that activity, day after day, or maybe not every day, but every opportunity, at some point in time, what we're supposed to be doing in high school is we're supposed to be learning and preparing ourselves for college and for the world. When I got out of high school, the only thing I knew how to do was drink and play soccer. That's it. I had no academic capabilities whatsoever to move on to in my life at all. And I had the opportunity, I don't know how, but this little school in southwestern Ohio called Marietta College wanted me to come. So I thought, all right. And that was a nice opportunity because that gave me every opportunity to drink with nobody watching. And if there ever is a line that we, you know, the line that we cross, it was in 1987 when I was 18 years old. And if there was ever a point of no return, it was at that time. There were warning signs, ominous warnings, which I failed to heed along the way. And as I look back at it, I realized that I never had the opportunity or never had the capability to correctly inventory my situation. Everything that came up in my life, everything that occurred in my, whether it was during school or during ball practice or with my parents, I could never see the truth. I could never see my part of it. Every time I looked in the mirror, I saw something just, you know, I was all right. You were always my problem. I could always find the problem in y'all. I could never see it in myself. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if that's a characteristic of alcoholics as a whole or some people as a whole. But I had it, and I had it bad. I did not have an opportunity, did not have the capability to correctly assess my situation. So I went to college, and I drank a lot, and I played ball. And I was a pretty decent soccer player. I was a lousy student, but I was an excellent drinker. Excellent. Excelled at it. Did it really well. Did it a lot. And the every morning drinking became a reality. And I was starting to drink to get rid of last night, to get the fog, to lift the fog a little bit. And the funny thing about this is I did not remember that. In sobriety, I did not remember that until I was probably 2 or 3 years sober, that I was actually a morning drinker. When you all talked about that you were a morning drinker, I was like, that's terrible. And then one day, whether it was a speaker meeting, I realized that, yeah, that's the way I was too. After soccer season ended, though, I didn't have any. I wasn't a student, and it went downhill really fast. And I made it one semester at that school. And at Christmas time, got that wonderful little mailogram that said, Mr. Thiel, you are hereby expelled from Marietta College. And again, somebody of of right mind or whatever would have been able to assess the situation and see what's going on with this picture. I called him up saying, there has to be some type of mistake. There's got to be something wrong with the situation. This is not me. This does not happen to me. Apparently you don't know who I am. You know, that kind of arrogant attitude, stupidity that I carried to every place that I went. And I went down, I actually drove all the way down there, had an appointment with the dean, the whole nine yards. No, of course it was true. I had failed every single class that I took. As a matter of fact, one of my finals, I was so drunk the night before that for 2 hours, I slept through my alarm that was going off. And I went to the class, and I said, I slept, I was studying late, and the guy never bought it, and he said, you've been drinking. I said, well, I had a few beers last night, but he said, you've been drinking. And there's the door. Hit the road. Another ominous warning which I failed to heed. You know, again, the inability to look at the truth, look at the reality in my life. At this point in time, my father made a wonderful suggestion. He said, you know, I really think you need a little discipline in your life. And I said, okay. He said, I'm going to send you to Europe for 6 months to work for my company. I said, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'll be away from home, you know, and I don't know. Okay, we'll try that. So I went to France for 2 months and developed a nice taste for red wine. And but that wasn't much fun because I like to drink and they like to sip. And I didn't like that. I like to drink. So 2 months later, I went to Switzerland, and they like to drink. And I like to drink. So we drank a lot. But the situations came up in that period of time where I began to black out even more. I had small, you know, situations in the past where I didn't remember a few hours. But somebody always told me what happened. I said, well, did I have a good time? Yeah, you had a great time. Well, then, all right then. As long as we all had a good time. But this period of time, I began to lose entire evenings. And one specific evening, when I was in Germany, the company had rented me a bike to get around town in. And I often rode that bike intoxicated. I never got pulled over for drinking and biking, but I could have very easily at any time. And one particular evening, I told my friend that I was going to meet him at this specific bar, but that was at like, you know, 10:30, something like that. So I had a lot of time to go drink. So I went over to this other bar and drank. And by the time I got to the bar, I it was a little bit later than that. And I walked out a couple hours later, and my bike was gone. Somebody stole my bike. And I called my boss the next day, and, you know, it turns out that his brother was the chief of police in that small town. So we went down, we did all this stuff, and, you know, wrote out the missing bike report. And there's actually, I have a newspaper clipping that says, bike stolen, da-da-da-da-da, Mr. Thiel, and it's like, oh, that's really nice. And 3 days later, he calls me into his office, and he says, we found your bike. I said, really? That's great. That's wonderful. Where was it? About 10 feet from where you said you left it. In a bush. Apparently I had gotten drunk and blacked out and forgot where I left my bike. And the silly thing about that, it's a cute story, but I go back to that company on an annual basis, and nobody remembers my name, but they remember the bike. They remember the bike. And at this point in my life, people aren't remembering me, they're remembering my actions. And they're saying things like, that's okay, Chuck, you just drank too much. Or, that's okay, Chuck, you were just blacked out. And that began to not sit well with me, because I wasn't relying on my wonderful personality anymore. It was because I was blacked out the whole time. The I came home from Europe and quickly got my first DWI, which was a wonderful experience. I don't remember it. I do remember waking up in the back seat of the cop car doing the paddy wagon prayer. Dear Lord, if you get me out of this one, I'll never do it again. You know, the old, and no. And I went to jail, and again, I was saying to myself, what's going on? There's some, must be some mistake. This doesn't happen to me. Again, the inability to see the reality, the truth. A lot of people will call that denial. No. That's just stupidity. That's just plain stupidity. I didn't know what the truth was. This is now the fall of 88. And that's following summer. I got another DWI. And that one was okay, because I remembered it and I really realized that I was drinking, and I better really take a look at this situation. A moment of clarity. Maybe I ought not try to drink for a week. Drinking wasn't the problem. Not drinking for a week was a problem. I could not not drink. A week later, I got pulled over for my third one. And I went back to the same jail. And the same jailer, as he's shutting the door, says, "Weren't you in here about a week ago?" And I said, "Yeah, I was in here about a week ago." And he said, "Don't you think you have a problem?" I said, "Yeah, man, I have the worst luck in town. I cannot catch a break from you guys. You get me every time. I don't drink that often, but when I do, you always get me." Again, you would think that at some point in time I'd see the light, or we'd see the light, but I was unable to see any of the truth whatsoever. I had a friend at this point in time who was working doing some volunteer work in a treatment center. And she said, "I think it would probably be a pretty good idea for you to go talk to these people." And my lawyer seemed to think that it was a good idea too. So I went and talked to them, and I went back to my lawyer and said, they suggested something called outpatient therapy. And my lawyer looked at me and he said, "No, no. You either spend 30 days in a treatment center inside the doors, or you spend 30 days in jail. You make the choice." And I had to think about that. Did I not want to drink, or did I want to at least... I chose, if there was really a choice, I chose to go to treatment. And a week before I went in for that little restful 30 days of bliss, the guys all got together and they threw me a party. Why? Because Chuck's going to treatment. So we blew it out big time, and it was homecoming weekend, and Western Michigan was playing Central Michigan, and da da da. And I don't remember a hell of a lot about the evening, because that was blacked out for a little bit, but I remember waking up and we're trying to roll this burned out car over, and there's about 200 of us in a circle, and we're rolling this car over, and through the crowd comes this beer bottle and smacks me right on the head, and I get knocked out. And I wake up and didn't know where I was. Another ominous warning, which I failed to heed. I mean, I'm getting them. God is saying, "Hey, kid, let's look at this situation. Let's try to assess this situation and take some corrective measures." And I never saw it. I couldn't see it. I had that. I had plenty of opportunities. Then I went to treatment, and that was a hell of a lot of fun. We prayed, and we held hands, and we held grief centers, and I was grieving the loss of my alcohol and all this happy horse hockey. And I And I honestly didn't get a heck of a lot from the activity. But when I got out of there, I realized that I couldn't drink and drive anymore. So, and they introduced us to AA meetings here at this center. And I remember going to my first AA meeting, and then that evening going back and journaling about it. And I recently picked up the journal, and the ledger said something to the effect of, first day was grand, everyone is so nice, you know, and something a bit funny was this thing called the AA meeting. And it said something to the effect of, I know I'm an alcoholic, I know I have an alcohol problem, but I can't be like these people. They're really sick. Really. And so I left that treatment center going to AA meetings, not to stay sober, not to find God, not to look for a spiritual experience, but to not drink and drive. Because I knew that if I got back in that car, I was going to kill somebody or kill myself. So I started going to AA meetings for that purpose. And in this small period of time, in October of 89, I started to develop this. Well, preface this by saying that I was taking something called Anabuse. And those of you know, anybody know Anabuse? Yeah. They suggest that you don't drink on Anabuse. It's a strong suggestion. And I took it. But it didn't say anything about smoking dope. There was nothing on the label about smoking pot. So I developed this very interesting non-habit-forming, although habit-forming, marijuana problem. And the only reason I mention that is because it led me back to the drink. Because I was not sober. I was not sober, in my terminology. By the way, let me preface this by saying, I wanted to say this earlier, is I'm not speaking for AA. I don't speak for the fellowship as a whole. This is my story. This is the way I understood it. It may not be totally clear today. Some of the people in here could probably tell my story a lot better than I can. So if I offend anybody tonight, that's tough. Call your sponsor. Anyway, so marijuana led me back to the bottle. And on January 6th of 1990, I was in a business meeting, or just ended a business meeting in Minneapolis. And me and this agent of mine went to a hotel, and we're having dinner. And the waiter comes over and he says, what will you have to drink? And I said, I'll have a tangeria and tonic. I didn't even know what a tangeria and tonic was. But it was nice. It had a cool shape of the bottle. It was blue. It looked good. And that went so well, I decided to have another. And I remember thinking back to what my father says, if you're going to drink, drink on a full stomach. And it was okay because I was eating. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? And later that night, I met up with an ex-girlfriend of mine in down on campus, and I was drunk. And she said something that was very disturbing to me. She said, Chuck, I thought you went to treatment. I thought you were sober. And with all the honesty I could summarize at that point in time, I said, oh, it is great. Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. Sobriety is a great thing. And that's cute and it's funny, but I don't think I've ever done a more damaging thing in my life than to give her that impression about Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish that I could change that. If there's one thing that I wish that I could change about my experience in AA is that moment at that time. But I can't. What I can do today is be the best member that I can be. in all of my activities, in every, not just in meetings, not just at coffee afterwards, not just at work, not with my family, not at church, but in all my activities. So I continued on the marijuana maintenance program, and the people in my home group at the time, it wasn't I didn't have a home group. The place where I was attending meetings in Michigan, in Kalamazoo, Michigan, began to shun away from me a little bit. I had picked up this nickname and treatment, which was Skippy. I don't know why. And they began to call me White Chip Skip. That hurts. That, the ego. Right like that. I can still go back to Kalamazoo today, go back to that same club, and I'll walk in and they'll go, Skippy! Or White Chip. They don't even know my name. Again, don't know me, but know my actions. Know my reputation. Mm-mm, that's not good. And so these people finally said, no. We've had enough of you. You've been hanging around here for 4 or 5 months. You haven't done any of the things that we do. You're leeching off us for rides, for money, for whatever. You're just using us and using this fellowship. Hit the road. And I was like, but you're supposed to love me till I can love myself. And all this crap that I heard, you know, all this sick, sick stuff that we tell each other sometimes. And they said no. And a couple weeks later, I was in a speaker meeting just like this. And I don't know what the guy was talking about, but I instantly, at that period of time, wanted to go out and get hammered. I wanted to get drunk so bad I could taste it. And I had no idea what to do. It never happened to me before in an AA meeting. The obsession was just absolutely overpowering. And I did something really stupid. I went up to a woman and I talked to her about it. And I said, I don't know what to do. I really want to drink really bad. What do I do? And she really perplexed me and she said, have you ever asked God to remove the desire to drink from you? I said, no, that sounds really silly. Why would God be interested in if I drank or not? She said, have you? I said, no. She said, you may want to try that. I said, okay. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know if this was a week or 2 weeks or a day or whatever. But after some period of time, I looked back and I didn't want to drink. And that obsession had been lifted. It was gone. I understood the first step. I understood what it meant to be powerless over alcohol, whether I was drinking or not drinking. From here. Because it centers in my mind. And thus I began my relationship with y'all. Really. And about 9 months later, I had the wonderful opportunity to move to Huntsville, Alabama. I'm a Yankee, man. What am I doing down here, you know? It was a wonderful opportunity. I didn't have anything holding me in Michigan. It was great. What the heck? Let's give this a shot. So I came down here knowing that I'm an alcoholic and knowing that I need meetings and understanding what the fellowship is at that point in time. Didn't know anything about the steps. Didn't know anything about the big book. But I knew about the fellowship and I knew that I was an alcoholic and I knew I needed meetings. So I moved down here and I began to go to meetings. But you all talk. Obviously, you talk differently, but I mean, one meeting I heard this guy call himself an alcoholic, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, but what's an alcoholic? Where does that come from? But you all said, you were talking differently. You were talking about sponsorship, and you were talking about the story. And I'm certain they were doing that up north, too, but I never heard it. And I began to ask questions like who, what, where, why, and how. And I got involved in the steps of recovery. And I took my fourth step. And up until my fourth step, I did not feel like I was a part of you. I didn't know I needed to feel like I was a part of you. But after my fourth and fifth step, I knew I was a part of you. I knew I was a part of the big picture as a whole. And that was a really cool feeling for me. Because I am somebody, there are probably some people in here like me too, maybe not, I'm going on a limb here, but who can be in a crowded room with hundreds of people and know that you're the only one who feels that way. I am so self-centered that I think that way. And after my first, fourth, and fifth step, that slowly slipped away. Then I had a wonderful opportunity to meet a man that truly, truly saved. Saved my life. I don't know if that's true or not, but it was an instrument and a catalyst to move me to bigger and better things, and taught me everything that I knew about AA. Told me how to respect the fellowship. Told me how to respect the people in the fellowship. Told me about the traditions and how it's vital that we follow these things, so that if my kids ever need it or your kids ever need it, it will be here. You know, I'm one of those people, and society today is so into instant gratification. I am so into instant gratification that I forget about what's going to happen, 10 years from now. I want to know what you're going to do for me right now. No. This is designed, and if we follow it correctly, it'll be here for a long time. And this gentleman by the name of Clay taught me that. And I will be indebted for that to him for the rest of my life. And the fellowship group in this town of Huntsville, Alabama, I believe, truly, is the finest group, AA group, in the country, in the world, for that matter. And I don't know what it is, but it changed me. Y'all changed me. Whatever it was, whatever I was, as a result of that group and you people, it changed me. And I thank you very much for that. After about four years of sobriety, and after work and after running up and down, I was a sales agent, and I was running up and down the state of Tennessee and North Mississippi and North Alabama, and it was wonderful. I was going to meetings from Jackson to Memphis to Lewisburg to Clarksville and Clinton and all over the place. It was just great. I got to meet so many wonderful people and see so many different fellowships within the fellowship, so many different communities. It was wonderful. But I got to thinking, which is not a good thing for me. Instead of doing, I started thinking that I needed to go back to school and get my education. And I used to say that, but in reality, I had another motive, and that is that I was chasing a woman. And I spoke, had the opportunity to speak with the Young People's Conference here last summer, and I told them that I was moving to Birmingham because I wanted to go back to school. And some of my friends came up to me afterwards and suggested that I rethink that, my motive, and remember that there was a little blonde also. So the truth is I moved to Birmingham to chase a blonde. And the school was a byproduct and a side bet. But I went, and all things aside, it was a great opportunity for me to meet Tim and Daryl and the rest of my good friends from Birmingham. And the fellowship there was really, really warm and really kind for me. And I thank you, the Highland Park group there, and Five Points, and It was great. What a wonderful experience. And I never thought that kid from Michigan, how did a kid from Kalamazoo, Michigan end up in Birmingham, Alabama? I don't know how that happens. But it's as a result of God, you people, and this fellowship that's the way that works. And I started to think again, and again, that's not a good thing for me. And I'm thinking that I need to move again. And my company gave this opportunity to move to Texas and to start a new territory. And I looked at it as another, okay, we can give this a shot. And I moved to Texas almost three years ago, to Austin. And I began to go to meetings and go to groups and looking for a home group and looking for a sponsor and things like that. And I was looking for somebody who was perfect. I was looking for somebody who was like Harry and like Tim and like Clay. Basically, I was looking for somebody exactly like me. And I never found that person. So I decided that I would sponsor myself for a little while. For about a year. Yeah. What a miserable, miserable time in my life. It's funny, when you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, nobody asks you to sponsor them. Nobody asks you to do things. Nobody really wants you around. And I became really, really pretty self-centered. And my actions showed it. I was at a meeting one day, and my girlfriend, of course, had just broken up with me. And I was distraught. And I had seen this guy quite a few times. And I liked what he had to say. And I asked him if he'd sponsor me. And he agreed. He was an Irish Catholic, for Christ's sake. You know, I don't know anything about that, but I thought we'd give it a try. And about 2 months later, he asks me, he says, "Chuck, why did you ask me to sponsor you?" And I said, "Quite frankly, I don't know. I think it had something to do with the way you treated your wife and the way you treated other people." See, I'd had the tradition big book thumper. I'd had the 10-step junkie. But I didn't know how to treat people. And I didn't know how to interact within the fellowship or in society as a whole. And everything works out. At any rate, that's almost 2 years ago now, and Hank's a wonderful guy. He and his wife Tricia have been wonderful to me. But just as soon as I finish a fourth and a fifth step, people are coming up to me again, and they're asking me to sponsor them again. What a novel concept. Work the steps, have something what people want, give it away. If you haven't got anything you want, they're not going to ask you for it. If they ask you for it, you probably ought to run away. The fellowship in Austin has been wonderful. We have probably 40 or 50 groups and about 500 meetings a week. And in this period of time, I've had the opportunity to visit a number of different places in the country, around the world, to be honest with you. The job that I have now has taken me to Europe and to South America and to Mexico. And I've had the great opportunity to sit in meetings in AA in Mexico and not speak a word of English, but to absolutely, absolutely, without a doubt, understand exactly what they're talking about. Don't know what they're saying, but know what they're talking about. The difficult thing about sobriety today, for me, has to do with daily 10-step work. I have guys that I sponsor who make lists and who go back over the day and rehearse their day exactly as the big book. suggest that we do. And to be honest with you, I haven't done that for a long time. And it's meetings like this, as I'm hearing it, remind me that I need to take care of some things. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I think I have to. About almost a little over 4 years ago, I was in North Carolina on a business trip, and this is sporadic and it's just coming to me, so forgive me for not staying on task. But about 4 years ago, I was in North Carolina, and I got a call from my mother, and she said that my brother, my younger brother, had been in this terrible accident. He had gone to Germany to do the same thing that I was doing when I went to Germany. And he had been in this rollerblading accident, and it was very grave, and then he may not survive. And as I hung up with the phone with my mother, I dropped down to my knees, and I said these words, and I don't know where these words come from. I have no idea where these words come from, but something to the effect of, if you're going to take them quickly and painlessly. And I think that's the most honest thing that I've ever said in my life. And the most unselfish thing that I've ever said in my life. And it really, I really began to understand what, at that point in time, what prayer and meditation really is all about. That at some point in time, there is maybe a channel that's really open. I don't know, but I felt at that point in time. And I knew instantly, I knew at that point in time that he was going to die. And that I was going to give a eulogy. And we were going to have a great party. And it would be a wonderful, wonderful time. And the next morning he passed away. But that night, I got on the phone. And I called everybody that I knew. And there are many people in this room who I called. And I don't know what happened. I'm not even going to question what happened. But thank you. Thank you very much. When I came here, when I came to AA, I didn't have a problem. I didn't have a problem with booze. I had a problem with drinking and driving. Driving was my problem. Drinking was not the problem. I knew how to do that real well. For some reason, I stayed long enough to see or to hear or to feel or something happened. And I know today, I could not even comprehend not drinking. I could not, when someone would tell me, all you have to drink is, oh, we just do this one day at a time. I saw through that. If I put enough one day at a time together, I won't drink for a long time. I saw through that crap. But you all showed me how to do it. And you cared enough for me to let me go and to kick me out and then to come back when I was ready. And you prayed with me and you cried with me and you've done more for me than I could ever do for you. But I'm indebted to you and to this fellowship. My sponsor, Hank, who would have liked to have been here tonight, always suggests that I leave with a prayer. So I'm going to close tonight with a prayer. And those of you who want to join me, you can join me. This is to me from you, to you from me. Dear God, I give thanks for what you have freely given to me today through thy grace and thy will and thy love. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my fellowship, for my family, for my dear friends. Thank you for AA. Because without AA, we wouldn't be here. Thanks, everybody. Have a good weekend.